Leviathan, Part 2, Commonwealth, by Thomas Hobbes. First published in 1651. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapters 22 through 24. Chapter 22. Systems. Subject, Political and Private. Having spoken of the creation, form, and power of a commonwealth, I now reach the topic of a commonwealth's parts. I start with systems which resemble the homogeneous parts of a natural body, its muscles. By system, I mean any number of men joined in one interest or one business. Some systems are regular, some irregular. The regular ones are those where one man, or assembly of men, is constituted as representative of the whole number. All the others are irregular. Some regular systems are absolute and independent, subject to no one but their own representative. They are all commonwealths, which I have already dealt with. All the other regular systems are dependent or subordinate, that is, subordinate to some sovereign power, to which everyone is subject, as is also their representative. Of systems that are subordinate or dependent, some are political and some private. Political systems, otherwise called bodies politic and persons in law, are made by authority from the sovereign power of the Commonwealth. Private systems are constituted by subjects amongst themselves, or by authority from a foreigner. For an authority derived from power within one Commonwealth is, within the dominion of another Commonwealth, not public, but private. Some private systems are lawful, some unlawful. Systems that are allowed by the Commonwealth are lawful. All other are unlawful. Irregular systems, consisting only in the concourse of people with no representative, are lawful if they are not forbidden by the Commonwealth, or made with an evil purpose. Examples would be the gathering of people at markets or shows, or for any other harmless purpose. But when the intention is evil, or, for large groups, unknown, they are unlawful. In bodies politic, the power of the representative is always limited, and what sets its limits is the sovereign power. For unlimited power is absolute sovereignty. And in every commonwealth, the sovereign is the absolute representative of all the subjects, so no one else can represent any part of them except within the limits set by the sovereign. To permit a body politic of subjects to have an absolute, that is, unlimited, representative, would be, to all intents and purposes, to abandon the government of that part of the commonwealth, and to divide the dominion. And this would be contrary to their peace and defence. For the sovereign to be understood to do that, he must plainly and explicitly free them from their subjection. It must be done explicitly to be effective, for consequences of his words are not signs of his will, when other consequences point in a different direction. Rather, they are signs of error and miscalculation, to which all mankind is too prone. How the power given to the representative of a body politic is limited can be learned from two things. One is their writ or letters, the other is the law of the commonwealth. When a commonwealth is first established, nothing needs to be written down, because in that case the power of the representative has no bounds, except what are laid down by the unwritten law of nature. But in subordinate bodies, so many different limitations are needed, concerning their businesses, times, and places, that they can't be remembered unless they are written down, and can't be observed unless their written versions are letters patent, that is, open documents issued by a monarch or government to authorize an action or confer a right, documents that can be read to the people and are attested to by carrying some permanent sign of the sovereign's authority. Such limitations are not always easy to describe in writing, perhaps sometimes not even possible. So the ordinary laws of the Commonwealth as a whole must settle what the representative may lawfully do, in all cases where the official letters are silent. And therefore, in a body politic, whose representative is one man, if he does something in his official capacity, not warranted in his letters patent or by the laws, it is his own act, and not the act of the body or of any other member of it, because outside the limits set by his letters or the laws, he represents no man's person except his own. But what he does in accordance with his letters patent and the laws is the act of everyone, for everyone is an author of the sovereign's act, because he is unrestrictedly their representative, and the act of someone who conforms to the letters of the sovereign is itself an act of the sovereign, and therefore every member of the body is an author of it. But if the representative is an assembly, anything the assembly does that isn't warranted by their letters patent or by the laws is an act of the assembly or of the body politic which it represents, and it is the act of everyone who voted for the decree, but not of any man who voted against it or was absent, unless he voted for it by proxy. It is an act of the assembly, because it was voted for by a majority. And if it's a crime, the assembly may be punished, so far as it can be punished, by dissolution or forfeiture of their letters, which for such artificial and fictitious bodies is tantamount to capital punishment, or by a monetary fine, if the assembly has property in which none of the innocent members has shares. For nature has exempted all bodies politic from bodily penalties. You can't flog or imprison a body politic. But those who didn't give their vote are innocent, because the assembly can't represent any man in things unwarranted by their letters, and consequently the innocent minority are not involved in the majority's votes. The variety of bodies politic is almost infinite, for they are distinguished not only by the different concerns for which they are constituted, but also differences in their scope, coming from differences in times, places, and numbers of members. As to their concerns, some are ordained for government. First on the list, as involving the political entity one level down from a commonwealth, is the government of a province, which may be committed, that is, entrusted, to an assembly of men, with all its resolutions decided by majority vote. And then this assembly is a body politic, and their power is limited by the terms in which their governing role was given to them. When someone transfers the responsibility for some of his business to another person, to manage it for him and under his authority, that responsibility is what is signified by the word province. So when one commonwealth has different regions that have different laws or are geographically far apart, and the administration of the government of those regions is committed to different people, the regions in question, where the sovereign is not resident but governs by commission, are called provinces. But there are few examples of a province being governed by an assembly residing in the province itself. The Romans had the sovereignty of many provinces, but governed them always through presidents and magistrates, and not as they governed the city of Rome and adjacent territories, namely through assemblies. Similarly, when people were sent from England to establish colonies in Virginia and Bermuda, though their government here was committed to assemblies in London, those assemblies never committed their government there to any assembly of people living there, but rather sent one governor to each colony. For although every man naturally wants to take part in government, if he can be present where the procedures of government are going on, when men can't be present, they are inclined, also naturally, to commit their common interest to a monarchic rather than a democratic form of government. We see this in the behaviour of men with private estates, who, when they don't want the work of administering their own affairs, choose to trust one servant rather than an assembly of their friends or their servants. But whatever happens, in fact, we can entertain the idea of the government of a province or colony being committed to an assembly. The point I want to make is that if this did happen, any debt contracted by that assembly, or any unlawful act decreed by it, would be the act only of those who assented, and not of any that dissented or were absent. And another point. An assembly residing outside the colony that it governs can't exercise any power over the persons or the possessions of any member of the colony, or seize on them for debt or other duty, in any place outside the colony itself, because it has no jurisdiction or authority anywhere but within the colony. And even if the assembly have a right to impose a fine on any of their members who break their laws, they have no right to enforce such fines outside the colony. And what I have said here about the rights of an assembly for the government of a province or a colony applies also to an assembly for the government of a town, a university, a college, a church, and to any other government over the persons of men. If any particular member of a body politic thinks he has been wronged by the body itself, the right of dealing with his case belongs to the sovereign, and to those whom the sovereign has appointed to be judges in such cases, or has appointed for this case in particular. It doesn't belong to the body itself, for in this situation the whole body is his fellow subject. It would not be like that in a sovereign assembly, where there can be no judge at all if it is not sovereign, even if that involves his being judge in his own cause. In a body politic, whose function is to control foreign trade, the most appropriate representative is an assembly of all the members, so that anyone who has risked his money on a trading venture can, if he wishes, be present at all the body's deliberations and resolutions. To see the case for this, consider why men who are merchants, and can buy and sell, export and import their merchandise according to their own discretions, nevertheless bind themselves together to form one corporation. This isn't the question of why they enter into joint trading ventures, a question that has a straightforward answer. Few merchants are in a position to buy enough at home to fill a ship for export, or to buy enough abroad to fill a ship and bring it home. So merchants generally need to join together in one society, where each merchant can share in the profits in proportion to his risk, or else go it alone, and sell what he exports or imports at whatever prices he thinks fit. But this is not a body politic, because there's no common representative to oblige them to any laws, other than the ones that also oblige all other subjects. So it is not my topic. When merchants form a corporation, that is, a body politic of the kind I have been writing about, their purpose in incorporating is to increase their profits in either of two ways, by sole buying at home and by sole selling abroad, so that to allow a number of merchants to be a corporation or body politic is to give them a double monopoly, as sole buyers and as sole sellers. For when a company is incorporated for any particular foreign country, they alone export the commodities that can be sold in that country, which means that they are sole buyers at home and sole sellers abroad. This is profitable to the merchants, because it enables them to buy at home at lower rates and sell abroad at higher rates. And in the other direction, there's only one buyer of foreign goods and only one seller of them at home, both which are again profitable to the merchants. One part of this double monopoly is disadvantageous to the people at home, the other to foreigners. For at home, the merchants can, as the only exporters, set what price they please on the produce and manufactured products of the people. And as the sole importers, they can set what price they please on all foreign goods that the people need. And both of these are bad from the people's point of view. In the reverse direction, as the sole sellers of the homeland's goods abroad, and sole buyers of foreign goods over there, they raise the price of the former and lower the price of the latter, both to the disadvantage of the foreigner. Such corporations are therefore nothing but monopolies, though they would be very profitable for a commonwealth if they were cut in half, so to speak, that is, if they were bound up into one body in foreign markets, whereas a monopoly they could sell dear and buy cheap, and did not exist as a monopoly at home, where every man was at liberty to buy and sell at what price he could. The purpose of such a monopolistic body politic is not to bring profit to the body as a whole. Indeed, the body as such has no wealth, except what is deducted from the individual trading ventures to pay for building, buying, equipping, and manning the ships. Rather, the purpose is the profit of each individual trader. That is why each of them should be acquainted with how his own possessions are being used, by belonging to the assembly that controls such uses, and should be acquainted with their accounts. So the representative of such a body must be an assembly, where every member of the body can, if he wishes, be present at the consultations. These bodies made for governing men or trade are either perpetual or set up for a limited time, set down in writing. But there are some bodies whose times are limited not by any written rules, but by the nature of their business. Here would be an example of that. A sovereign monarch, or sovereign assembly, commands the towns and other parts of his territory to send him their deputies to inform him about the condition and needs of his subjects, or to advise him regarding the making of good laws, or for any other purpose. These deputies are assigned a place and time of meeting. They come together as ordered, and are then a body politic representing every subject of that dominion. But this body politic exists only for matters put to them by the man or assembly who sent for them. And when it is declared that there are no more matters for them to consider or debate, the body is dissolved. Regular and lawful private bodies are ones constituted without letters patent or any other written authority, apart from the law of the land. And because they are united in one representative person, they are classified as regular. They include all households in which the father or master orders the whole household, for he creates obligations for his children and his servants, as far as the law permits. That far, but no further, because none of them are bound to obey him by performing actions that the law has forbidden. In all other actions, during their time under domestic government, they are subject to the fathers and masters who are their immediate sovereigns, as it were. Before the institution of commonwealth, the father and master is absolute sovereign in his own household. The only authority he loses through the institution is what is taken from him by the law of the commonwealth. Regular but unlawful private bodies are those that unite themselves into one representative person without any public authority at all. Examples are the corporations of beggars, thieves, and gypsies, formed so as to succeed better in their trade of begging and stealing, and the corporations of men who combine for the easier propagation of doctrines, and for making a party against the power of the commonwealth, doing this by authority from some foreigner. Irregular systems, which are in their nature merely leagues, become lawful or unlawful according to the lawfulness or unlawfulness of each individual's reason for belonging to the league, and his reason is to be understood from the intersection of his private interests with the league's business. Sometimes an irregular system is not even a league, but merely a concourse of people who work together to a common end, solely because they have similar wants and inclinations. A commonwealth is just a league of all the subjects together. Leagues of subjects within a commonwealth are commonly made for mutual defence, so they are for the most part unnecessary, and savour of unlawful design, and for that reason they are unlawful, and are commonly labelled as factions or conspiracies. Leagues of commonwealths are different. A league is a connection of men by covenants. If, as in the raw condition of nature, no power is given to any one man or assembly to compel the members to keep their covenant, the league is valid only as long as there arises no good reason for distrust. And therefore leagues between commonwealths, over which there is no human power established to keep them all in awe, are not only lawful, but also profitable, for as long as they last. But leagues between the subjects of a single commonwealth, where everyone could obtain his right by means of the sovereign power, are unnecessary for the maintenance of peace and justice. And if their purpose is evil, or unknown to the commonwealth, they are also unlawful, for it's wrong for private men to unite their strength for an evil purpose. And if a league's purpose is unknown, this concealment is wrong, and the league is dangerous to the public. If the sovereign power belongs to a large assembly, and some members of the assembly come together without authority to discuss things on their own and to try to guide the other members, this is a faction or unlawful conspiracy, because it's a fraudulent seduction of the assembly for the faction's particular purposes. But if someone outside the assembly, whose private interest is to be debated and judged in the assembly, makes as many friends as he can among its members, there's nothing wrong with that, because he is not part of the assembly. Even if he hires such friends with money, that is all right, unless some law explicitly forbids it. For given how men behave, justice sometimes can't be had without money, and everyone is entitled to think his own cause to be just until it has been heard and judged. In all commonwealths, if a private man maintains more servants than are needed for managing his estate, and any other lawful work he has for them, this is faction, and is unlawful. For the man has the protection of the commonwealth, so he doesn't need the defence of private force. In some nations that are not thoroughly civilised, many families have lived in continual hostility, and have invaded one another with private force. But it's clear enough that either they have been wrong to do this, or else they had no commonwealth. Not only factions for kindred are wrong, but so also are factions for the government of religion, such as Papists, Protestants, etc., and factions of state, such as Roman patricians and plebeians, and Greek aristocrats and democrats. They are wrong because they are contrary to the peace and safety of the people, and because they take the sword out of the hand of the sovereign. A concourse of people is an irregular system, whose lawfulness or unlawfulness depends on its purpose, and on how many people it contains. If the purpose is lawful and obvious, the concourse is lawful. For example, an ordinary meeting of men at church or at a public show. But only if they are there in usual numbers. For if their number is extraordinarily great, their purpose in coming together is not evident, and consequently someone who can't explain in convincing detail why he is there should be judged to be aware that they have an unlawful and tumultuous purpose. It may be lawful for 1,000 men to join in a petition to be delivered to a judge or magistrate. But if 1,000 men come to present it, it is a tumultuous assembly, because only one or two are needed for that purpose. But in such cases as these, there's no set number, such that the assembly is unlawful if its membership reaches that number. What makes it unlawful is its having too many members for the available officers to be able to suppress it and bring it to justice. When an unusually large number of men assemble against a man whom they accuse, the assembly is an unlawful tumult, because their accusation could have been delivered to the magistrate by a few men, or by just one. Such was the case of St. Paul at Ephesus. That completes what I shall say concerning systems and assemblies of people. They can, as I have already said, be compared to the homogeneous parts of man's body, the lawful being comparable to the muscles, the unlawful ones to warts, boils, and abscesses, caused by the unnatural flowing together of bad bodily fluids. Chapter 23. The Public Ministers of Sovereign Power. In the last chapter, I have spoken of the aspects of commonwealth that generalize across all the subjects, not making distinctions among them. I now turn to aspects that distinguish some subjects from the rest. A public minister is someone whom the sovereign, whether a monarch or an assembly, employs in any affairs, with authority to represent in that employment the person of the commonwealth. This is different from a personal servant of the sovereign, as I now explain. Every sovereign, whether man or assembly, represents two persons, or in plainer terms has two capacities, of which one is natural and the other political. A monarch has the person not only of the commonwealth, but also of a man, and a sovereign assembly as the person not only of the Commonwealth, but also of the individual members of the assembly. Those who serve them in their natural capacity are not public ministers, a label reserved for those who serve them in the administration of public business. So public ministers do not include, in an aristocracy or democracy, the ushers, sergeants, and other officers that serve the assembly purely for the convenience of the assembled men, or, in a monarchy, the stewards, chamberlains, treasurers, or other officers of the royal household. Some public ministers have committed to them the charge of a general administration, either of the whole dominion or of a part of it, of the whole. The predecessor of an infant king may commit the whole administration of his kingdom to a protector or regent until the new king comes to be of age. In such a case, every subject is obliged to obey the regent's ordinances and commands, so long as he gives these in the king's name, and they are not inconsistent with his sovereign power. Of a part or province, a monarch or sovereign assembly may put a province under the general charge of a governor, lieutenant, prefect, or viceroy. And here again, everyone in that province is bound by everything the governor does in the name of the sovereign, that is not incompatible with the sovereign's right. For such protectors, viceroys, and governors have no other right but what depends on the sovereign's will, and nothing that is said to them should be interpreted as declaring the sovereign's wish to transfer the sovereignty, unless it contains clear, explicit words to that effect. This kind of public minister resembles the nerves and tendons that move the various limbs of a natural body. Other public ministers have special administration, that is, they are in charge of some special business, either at home or abroad. I shall characterize 5 kinds of ministry at home. First, for the economy of a commonwealth, there can be public ministers who have authority concerning the commonwealth's treasury, dealing with tributes, impositions, rents, fines, or any other public revenue, collecting, receiving, issuing, keeping accounts. These people are ministers because they serve the representative person, and can do nothing against his command or without his authority. And their ministry is public, because they serve him in his political capacity. Second, there can be public ministers who have authority concerning the armed forces of the Commonwealth, to have the custody of arms, forts, and ports, to recruit, pay, or transport soldiers, or to provide for anything needed for the conduct of war by land or by sea. Third, there can be public ministers who have authority to teach or enable others to teach the people their duty to the sovereign power, and to instruct them in the knowledge of what is just and unjust, thereby making them more apt to live in godliness and in peace among themselves, and to resist the public enemy. These are ministers because they do this not by their own authority, but by someone else's, and their ministry is public because they do it, or should do it, only by the authority of the sovereign. Only the monarch or the sovereign assembly has immediate authority from God to teach and instruct the people, and no one other than the sovereign receives his power from the favour of God and him alone. All others receive their authority to teach from the favour and providence of God and their sovereigns. Fourth, those to whom judicial authority is given are public ministers, for in their seats of justice they represent the person of the sovereign, and their sentence is his sentence. This is because all judicature is essentially tied to the sovereignty, and therefore all judges other than the sovereign are merely his or their ministers. And as controversies are of 2 sorts, of fact and of law, so also judgments are of 2 sorts, of fact and of law. And in a single legal case, therefore, there can be 2 judges, one of fact and the other of law. A disagreement, either of fact or of law, might arise between the party judged and the judge. And because they are both subjects to the sovereign, such a disagreement ought in fairness to be judged by men agreed on by both, for no man can be judge in his own cause. But they have already both agreed on the sovereign as judge, so he should either hear the disagreement and settle it himself, or appoint a judge they both agree on. These public persons, with authority from the sovereign power to instruct or judge the people, are members of the Commonwealth, who can appropriately be compared to the vocal organs in a natural body. Fifth, public ministers are also all those who have authority from the sovereign, to ensure that judgments are carried out, to make the sovereign's commands public, to suppress tumults, to arrest and imprison criminals, and to do other things tending to the conservation of the peace. Every act they perform by such authority is the act of the Commonwealth, and their service is comparable with that of the hands in a natural body. Public ministers abroad are those who represent the person of their own sovereign to foreign states. Such are ambassadors, messengers, agents, and heralds sent by public authority on public business. Ones who are sent on behalf of some private party of a troubled state, even if they are received at a foreign court, are neither public nor private ministers of the Commonwealth, because none of their actions have the Commonwealth for author. An ambassador sent from a prince to congratulate, condole, or appear at a ceremony is a private person and not a minister. Although his authority is public, the business is private, and belongs to him in his capacity as a natural man. Also, if a man is sent into another country to explore their plans and their strength secretly, though both his authority and his business are public, he is only a private minister, because as he goes about his secret work, no one sees him as bearing any person except his own. Yet he is a minister of the Commonwealth, and can be compared to an eye in the natural body. Those who are appointed to receive the petitions or other information from the people, and are, as it were, the public ear, are public ministers and represent their sovereign in doing that work. If we think of a counsellor or a council of state as having no authority to judge or command, and having only the role of giving advice to the sovereign when he asks for it, or of offering it to him when he doesn't ask, neither of them is a public person. For the advice is addressed only to the sovereign, and his person can't in his own presence be represented to him by someone else. But a body of counsellors are in fact never without some other authority of judicature, or of immediate administration. In a monarchy, they represent the monarch when delivering his commands to the public ministers. In a democracy, the council or senate is only a council when it announces to the people the result of its deliberations. But when it appoints judges, or hears legal cases, or gives audience to ambassadors, it does so in its role as a minister of the people. And in an aristocracy, the council of state is the sovereign assembly itself, and gives advice only to itself. Chapter 24. The Nutrition and Procreation of a Commonwealth. The nutrition of a commonwealth consists in the abundance and the distribution of materials that support life, in digesting it, preparing it, and in then conveying it along suitable channels to the public use. The abundance of matter is limited by nature to what comes from the land and the sea, the two breasts of our common mother. Usually God either gives us these goods or makes us work for them. This food for the Commonwealth is made up of animals, vegetables, and minerals, and God has freely laid these before us, on or near to the face of the earth, so that the only work we need to put in is in taking them, killing and butchering them, cultivating and harvesting them, digging them up. So having plenty of this food depends firstly on God's favour, and secondly on nothing but the labour and industry of men. This matter, or food, commonly called commodities, is partly domestic and partly foreign. Domestic, what can be found within the territory of the Commonwealth. Foreign, what is imported from other countries. No territory under the dominion of one Commonwealth, except a very vast one, produces everything needed to keep the whole body of the Commonwealth alive and functioning. and there are few that don't produce more than they need of something. So the superfluous commodities to be had within a dominion stop being superfluous, and serve to meet home needs through the importation of commodities that can be acquired from other countries, either by exchange, or by just war, or by labour. For a man's labour is also a commodity, that can, like anything else, be exchanged for some benefit. Indeed, there have been commonwealths that had no more territory than they needed to live on, but nevertheless maintained and even increased their power, partly by the labour of trading from one place to another, and partly by selling manufactured goods the raw materials for which were brought in from other places. The distribution of the materials that nourish the commonwealth is managed through the system of mine and thine and his, in a word, property. And in all kinds of commonwealth, this is in the hands of the sovereign power. For where there is no commonwealth, there is, I repeat, a perpetual war of every man against his neighbour, and therefore everyone has what he gets and keeps by force. And that is neither property nor community, but uncertainty. This is so obvious that even Cicero, a passionate defender of liberty, in a public pleading, attributes all ownership to the civil law. If the civil law is abandoned or retained, but negligently guarded, there's nothing that any man can be sure to receive from his parent or leave to his children. And again, take away the civil law, and no man knows what is his own and what is another man's. Because the introduction of property is an effect of the commonwealth, which can only act through the person who represents it, its distribution is the act of the sovereign alone, and consists in the laws, which can't be made by anyone who doesn't have the sovereign power. They knew this well in ancient times. Their word for what we call law was the Greek word nomos, meaning distribution, and they defined justice as distributing to every man his own. In this distribution, the first law concerns the division of the land itself. This is done by the sovereign, who assigns to each man a portion of land, according to what is judged to be fair and conducive to the common good. Judged by the sovereign, that is, not by any subject or any number of subjects. And though a people coming into possession of a land by war don't always exterminate the previous inhabitants, as the Jews did, but allow many, or most, or all, to retain their estates, it's obvious that from then onwards they hold their estates as assigned to them by the victors, as the people of England held all theirs as assigned by William the Conqueror. From this we can infer that a subject's ownership of his lands consists in a right to exclude all other subjects from the use of them, and not a right to exclude his sovereign, whether an assembly or a monarch. The sovereign, that is, the commonwealth whose person he represents, is understood always to act only for common peace and security. So this distribution of lands is to be understood as done for that same purpose. It follows that if he makes a distribution that endangers peace and security, that is contrary to the will of every subject who entrusted his peace and safety to the sovereign, and so it is to be regarded as void by the will of every one of these subjects. It's true that a sovereign monarch, or a majority of a sovereign assembly, may order things to be done in pursuit of their passions, and contrary to their own consciences. That would be a breach of trust and of the law of nature. But this fact isn't enough to authorize any subject to oppose his sovereign, to make war on him, to accuse him of injustice, or in any way to speak evil of him, because the subjects have authorized all his actions, and in giving him the sovereign power, they have made his actions their own. I shall discuss later the question of when the commands of sovereigns are contrary to fairness and to the law of nature. Here is a conceivable state of affairs. In the distribution of land, the commonwealth itself takes a portion, which it owns and improves through its representative. And this portion is improved enough to meet the whole expense of the common peace and defence. this might very well happen if there were any representative free from human passions and infirmities. But given what human nature is like, it's pointless to set aside public land or any certain revenue for the Commonwealth. If the sovereign power falls into the hands of a monarch or assembly that are too careless about money, or too risk-taking in committing the public wealth to a long or costly war, this arrangement will threaten to produce the dissolution of government and the condition of mere nature and war. And in any case, there's no way of predicting what a Commonwealth's needs will be. Commonwealths can't go on a diet. Their expenses are limited not by their own appetite, but by external events and the appetites of their neighbours. So what demands there will be on the public riches depends on casual and unexpected events. It is for the sovereign not only to distribute lands at home, but also to determine what commodities the subjects can trade to what foreign countries. If private persons could use their own discretion to make decisions about this, some of them would act badly so as to make a profit. They would provide the enemy with means to hurt the Commonwealth, and they would hurt it themselves by importing things that please men's appetites, but are nevertheless harmful to them, or at least do them no good. For the upkeep of a Commonwealth, it's not enough for every man to own a portion of land or some few commodities, or to have natural ownership of some useful practical skill. Every such skill is, or has products that are, necessary for the survival or for the well-being of almost every individual man. So it's necessary that men distribute what they can spare and transfer their ownerships by exchange and mutual contract. It is for the Commonwealth, that is, the sovereign, to settle how all kinds of contracts between subjects are to be made, and what words and signs will validate them. This applies to buying, selling, exchanging, borrowing, lending, renting, hiring, and so on. As regards the matter with which the Commonwealth is nourished, and how it is distributed to the Commonwealth's various limbs and organs, what I have said is sufficient, given the plan for this book as a whole. By digestion, I mean the process of taking all commodities that have not been consumed, and are being kept for future nourishment, and turning them into something of equal value that is portable. This is to make it possible for men to move from place to place, and to have in any particular place such nourishment as it can offer. This portable equivalent to commodities is simply gold and silver and money. For gold and silver happen to be highly valued in almost all countries of the world, which makes them a convenient measure of the value of everything else between nations. And money is a sufficient measure of the value of everything else between the subjects of the Commonwealth, whose sovereign coined the money, it doesn't matter what the coins are made of. By the means of these measures, gold and silver and money, all commodities, even ones that are physically immovable, can accompany a man wherever he goes, and can pass from man to man within the Commonwealth. Thus money circulates, nourishing every part of the Commonwealth as it passes, so that this process of digestion, as I have called it, can be said to put blood into the Commonwealth. For natural blood is similarly made of the fruits of the earth, and when it circulates, it nourishes every part of the human body that it passes through. Silver and gold have their value from the stuff itself, rather than having a value assigned by a sovereign. That gives them two privileges. First, their value can't be altered by the power of one or just a few commonwealths, because they are a common measure of the commodities of all places. But base money, that is, coins whose value is greater than that of the metal they are made of, can easily have its value lowered or raised. Secondly, gold and silver have the privilege of making commonwealths move and stretch out their arms into foreign countries, and to supply provisions not only for private subjects who travel, but also for whole armies. Not so with coins, whose value comes not from the value of the matter they are composed of, but from their being officially approved money in their own commonwealth. They don't travel well, because they can't stand a change of air, they do their work only at home, and there they are vulnerable to changes in the law, and thus liable to have their value diminished, often to the detriment of people who have them. The channels and paths along which money is conveyed to public use are of two sorts: one that conveys it to the public coffers, the other that sends it out again for public payments. The first sort include collectors, receivers, and treasurers. The second include treasurers, again, and officers appointed for payment of various public or private ministers. Here again, the artificial man, the Commonwealth, maintains his resemblance to the natural man. In the natural man, the veins receive the blood from various parts of the body, and carry it to the heart, where it is made vital. And the heart then sends it out again along the arteries, to enliven the man and enable the parts of his body to move. The offspring or children of a commonwealth are what we call colonies, which are numbers of men sent out from the commonwealth, under a leader or governor, to inhabit a foreign country that has no inhabitants, or is violently emptied of its inhabitants when the colony is established. And when a colony is settled, one of two things happens. The colony becomes a commonwealth on its own, with the colonists no longer being subject to the sovereign who sent them, as has been done by many commonwealths in ancient times, in which case the commonwealth from which they came is called their metropolis, or mother city, and it requires of them no more than fathers require of children, whom they set free from their domestic government, namely, honour and friendship. Or the colonists remain united to their metropolis, as were members of the colonies of the people of Rome, so that the colony is not itself a commonwealth, but a province, a part of the commonwealth that the colonists came from. So that what is right or wrong for colonies depends almost wholly on the license or letters patent through which their sovereign authorized them to settle there, the exception being their duty to honour and remain in league with their metropolis, a duty they have even if it was not explicitly specified. End of chapter 24.